basic English was one of the most important works to have an effect upon thinking about language in the next couple of decades. It's the most important linguistic work, because the object of the work was, in fact, to turn English into a universal language that everyone would speak according to certain rules, which would classify absolutely everything, every experience that anyone would ever have, would be applicable in terms of a classification system. And this incidentally followed a long line of universal classification systems, all equally erroneous and based upon philosophical idealism, going back to the end of the 1870s with the creation of, to my knowledge, the first universal language, which was called Volapük, which was in its own language the word speak, and then 10 years later Esperanto. And this attempt to classify absolutely everything that anyone ever said is, of course, a very dangerous thing, because the idea that the whole of reality can become reduced to one single set of linguistic symbols makes everyone have to become dishonest, because it means that you don't say what you want to say and find words to say it with, but you actually find yourself surrounded by words, and they enable you to have a limited number of choices of what you can say. And this is something that has very much happened in our own time. And I just mentioned, as a point of interest, that in the same year as Orwell's 1984 was published, another novel called The World of Null A, written by a novelist called Van Vogt, that was published, and that particular work was based upon precisely the assumption that, well, it's a science fiction work about the Earth being invaded by an alien species which imposes upon the world a universal language, enabling people only to think according to this alien language, forbidding people from being able to use words of their own. I think this issue about language is really important, because language is the greatest barrier to socialism. I mean, people, you know, it's very easy to say 1917 in Russia was the greatest barrier, or the Labour Party, and I think we have all said it, but in, I think, rather more serious historical terms, the greatest barrier to socialism seems to have been the process during the 20th century where language has been debased, constrained. People have been forced into narrower and narrower opportunities for linguistic expression. You've now got the politics of the soundbite, so if you've got anything to say, by all means say it, but make sure it doesn't last more than 15 seconds. You've got the Americanization of language, so there's a sort of world form of English, which is a step beyond Ogden's idea of basic English, which at least allowed for the idea of regional dialect, so that I don't know how many of you find it rather eerie when you listen to Russian economists and government ministers on television speaking with a broad Washington DC accent, but it certainly doesn't inspire me to think of freedom. And this, I think, is what has happened to language, and this is what the very act of a meeting like this, you know, I said to somebody before I was coming here today, I'm going to a meeting, and they said, what do you mean you're going? What's a meeting? And people don't go to meetings. I thought it was a meeting to discuss things. The whole idea of discussion has fallen into disuse, as it was at the time of Orwell, as it was indeed at the time when this Harry Enfield-type character was remembering Hyde Park, because of the fact that language is something people don't celebrate anymore. They don't sort of go out to rejoice in language. I would like to make a final point about what happened to control in reality rather than in fiction, and that is that I think Orwell got it wrong, that he didn't in fact see a process of capitalism intensifying and sophisticating its control by means of making people unhappy. You found that it sophisticated its control by making people happy, and that's why I believe that Aldous Huxley's book called Brave New World, published in 1932, was a far greater novel, an enduring novel, than Orwell's 1984. In fact, I think Orwell's 1984 is shock horror stuff, and that's why so many people read it. I don't think it changes their political views one way or the other. It doesn't make them a bit frightened. But I think that what all the Huxley's Brave New World does, and it pays rereading frequently, is it really shows you the depth that manipulators can go to push people into a position of submission and self-restraint by giving them simulated pleasures and pseudo happiness. And I think that's a far better book. And incidentally, Huxley himself wrote in the introduction to the second book that he wrote in 1962, Brave New World Revisited, that he believed that Orwell had been proved wrong and he had been proved right for precisely that reason, that the world had not advanced in its sophistication of control by means of the jackboot. It advanced by means of the slot machine and the television set that people chose to watch because they enjoyed it, and the game show and the the slogans and cliches of everyday life. That's what's really happened. And I, in a sense, I think Orwell is a bit of a distraction from that. But I think there is a sort of liberal assumption that as long as we're not living in a world where a jackboot is constantly stamping on a human face, somehow things are all right. Well, I'm not sure that's true. I actually think when you're living in a world where you can walk past people sleeping in a doorway in the cold weather, and people are out having what is called fun, one of the most pernicious terms of late 20th century capitalism, I have a greater worry about that person.
Can I just ask about Aldous Huxley? Did he write anything else apart from Brave New World Revisited and Brave New World? And do you know whether he had any political allegiances himself?
Yes. Huxley wrote an enormous number of novels apart from Brave New World and Brave New World Revisited. I mean, I suppose the one that people have, I'm not sure which one was sold most copies. I suppose the one most people here would have heard of is Point Counterpoint. But there are a number of novels by Huxley which are well written and well read. Huxley himself was very peculiar. He came from a scientific background. He was expected to be a scientist and wanted to be a scientist, nearly became a scientist, but for his extreme myopia, which prevented him from being able to see. In fact, he was blind for a brief period of his childhood, and then after that, discovered that he couldn't become a biologist as he wanted to. He was very much interested in science, and of course, Brave New World reflects his interest in the development of genetics and other subjects in the 1920s and 30s, and particularly reflects the kind of ideas that we found, which were a very great influence upon Huxley, of a writer called Burnham, who wrote a book called Peter Lawrence, you'll know what it's called, the name escapes me, I'm sorry, but it's called The Flesh, the Devil, and Something Else, and it's about science, and it's a very important book about how science can be used to control absolutely everything, give everybody maximum pleasure, to the extent, for example, that science is going to create a human race which was totally happy all of the time as a result of its own engineering, and it was and also proposed the universal language. But Huxley had a kind of Catholic view of human nature. In one of his essays that he wrote earlier on in his writing, in a collection of writings called Proper Studies, there's an essay called Equality. And in that essay, he writes about human nature. And he said, people can't ever be equal. People can't ever enjoy complete utopia as an impossibility. People having the opportunity, these are utopian propositions, equality, the freedom of people to have access to what they need and so on. He actually repudiates almost everything that socialists would stand for in this essay, but with very little foundation except for the fact that human beings are naturally greedy and naturally ill-equipped to cooperate. That was Huxley, as the historian from television, so that was Huxley.
Going back to the other thing you said about language, I didn't have enough time to concentrate on all the themes of the book in my opening comments, but just by way of demonstrating what the last contributor was saying, just from 1984, there's this language called newspeak, which is being gradually phased in, and ordinary English is being gradually phased out. And there's a character in the book called Syme, who's a language specialist, and he's one of the people who's got the job of actually creating this new language, which will limit people's thought by... I suppose to somebody of a scientific bent of mind, it initially has a certain kind of attraction in the sense of its logic and rationality, because what's happening is, instead of saying good and bad, it's good and ungood. It's a very mathematical sort of language. But it comes a bit unpoetical. If you want to say very good, it's got to be plus good, and extremely good would be double plus good. It's all mathematical. Anyhow, Simon becomes very enthusiastic about the whole thing and says to Winston, "Don't you see that the whole aim of newspeak is to narrow the range of thought?" This is almost word for word what the last contributor was saying. "In the end, we shall make thought crime literally impossible, because there will be no words in which to express it. Every concept that can ever be needed will be expressed by exactly one word, with its meaning rigidly defined and all its subsidiary meanings rubbed out and forgotten. Already in the 11th edition, we're not far from that point. But the process will still be continuing long after you and I are dead. Every year, fewer and fewer words, and the range of consciousness always a little smaller. Newspeak is Ingsoc, and Ingsoc is newspeak."
I'll just say that is based itself on this idea of Ogden and basic English, because actually, if you read that, you'll see that there was an attempt to turn negatives. Always, it was seen that there was a problem, that negatives didn't have a direct enough relationship to the word, to the original nouns. And there is also a relationship, I might say, between that and the work of somebody who had enormous significance in the 1930s, but none now, as far as I know, called Alfred Korzybski, who set up his Institute for Semantic Studies and wrote a book called Science and Sanity in 1933, and in that he actually again advocates that there should be a universal language in which you cannot say bad things. It was a very liberally intentioned thing, but of course, who is to decide what the bad things are going to be?
There's even an appendix to 1984 which contains a detailed grammatical exposition of the language. Always worked it out in some detail, and he points out that words like duck speak, which figured earlier on when I was referring to his onslaught on dogmatic orthodoxy, apparently these words could have either a good or a bad meaning depending on who it was used for. Provided the opinions which were quacked out were orthodox ones, it implied nothing but praise. And when the Times referred to one of the orators of the party as a double plus good duck speaker, it was paying a warm and valued compliment. It also says there that the word free is being phased out completely, apart from meanings such as "this dog is free of lice," but other than that, the word would simply not be usable, and therefore the concept would supposedly lose its meaning.
Before we go on now, I'd like to ask for a collection, and a mailing list will be going round. If you want to be kept informed of any future meetings and activities, which include our contest in the European Elections Chair.
You know, the title of the book is 1984, and the book was written in 48, 1949. And it sort of poses the very obvious question that when 1984 did come around, and now 1994, was it as bleak as always Orwell portrayed it, forecast it, which is taken to be in a literal sense, any more than any level can be taken completely literally. And how would you think, and it's difficult to answer this, how would you think Orwell would have seen 1984, would have lived, and indeed 1994? And then just one or two comments on my own. I think that when 1984 did come around, and then began 1994, in many ways it wasn't as bleak as he prophesied, if he wasn't prophesying it. I mean, you made mention of, in Britain, for instance, in 1948, in the post-war period, where things were rather grey-looking. standards were very low because of the immediate post-war period. Well, I remember that period, because I'm getting on, and I don't think it was completely as grey as he painted it. I think partly his difficulty was that he was pretty ill at the time, you know, and knew he was going to get, and I think this had something to do with his rather bleak attitude. But on the other hand, you go back, going into 1984, and then forward to 1994, where we are now, although in some senses, in terms of real poverty, but allowing for the recession, of course, things were not as bleak in our part of the world as he portrayed it in 48. In other senses, I think, Steve touched on this question of fun, things are even bleaker. The television's been mentioned, for instance. I saw a couple of programmes last night on television, which I'm not going to see again. I made a point of trying to find out exactly what they were about. One was called Don't Forget Your Toothbrush. Anybody seen that?
Oh, it's very good.
And the other one, I think it was immediately after that, was Television USA.
Oh.
Now, these both programmes, and the second one was even worse than the first.
They repeat that one, especially on Monday night.
Yeah, well, Christ, that's a real eye-opener of workers having fun. And I think if Orwell could have seen that, rather than the actual physical economic deprivation, which, you know, oh, I know we're now in recession, he would have taken an even bleaker attitude. Because in both these programmes, you have workers. I mean, I'll just briefly describe the first programme, the British programme, where you've got participants actually going to the TV studio with not only their toothbrushes, but suitcases and bags, anticipating a trip, which one of them actually got this week, was to the Seychelles. Now, look, not only come from London, come from the north of England, Crutler's where, with bloody suitcases and participate. I'm not going to describe what... Did you see it last night?
What do I have to do?
Well, it's the first time I've seen it, so I presume it must vary from week to week. People have to get up and be exactly out of phrase, but when do you last make love? And it was gradually whittled down. The winner, and he had to go, went to the Seychelles, you know, literally straight from the studio, after participating in, well, a man and a woman. They were the winner because they'd made love about 3 hours before in the Regent Palace Hotel. But I mean, these people getting up and... Not at all embarrassed, and perhaps you'd say, well, why the hell should they be embarrassed? But, and I thought it was all to do with manipulation and having fun. Now, the second programme, Television USA, I think that's the title, showed audience participation on various channels in America, the myriad channels, dealing essentially with crime, and they're really enjoying it. And this, I think, is disturbing because, to be honest, while millions of workers are in that frame of mind, and I'm not saying they are completely typical, but they're not atypical, are they? They're not going to go for centuries. So, in a sense, that is, it's bleak in that sense. So, I think Orwell was more, his prediction for the future was more than justified in one sense, but possibly less so in terms of the sheer economic deprivation, at least in this part of the world. In a general sense, but I'll shut up.
It's interesting that you focus on television because I suppose, in a sense, it's where Orwell got it wrong. You know, the one of the key features of his work is the idea of the telescreen in every room, and plays a very key part in the plot. But the whole point is that these screens are watching the people. I mean, it's like a television; you can watch it, but it's watching you as well. Interactive, two-way or what have you. Now, I think the technology for that sort of thing in his day was absolutely non-existent. So it showed quite a lot of foresight, because I think the technology for that kind of thing does exist now, more or less. There may not be one in every home, but I'm sure it's sort of feasible already. These two-way video phones are now on the market. So it's only one step from there to having the thing imposed. as I say, if you actually go through many of the tube stations in central London and look high up enough, you'll see cameras, yeah. Video cameras pointing, covering the entire space. It's a public place, which is under 24-hour surveillance. Yes.
But is it insidious?
That's true, they haven't got them in private homes, but that's, again, it's only one step, isn't it? So I don't think Orwell was that... I think it's wrong for us to debate about whether he got it right or got it wrong, because in a sense, 1984 is two-thirds political satire and one-third science fiction. We don't sit and debate whether H.G. Wells got it right or wrong about the time machine, because a lot of it is actually fanciful thinking. And in that sense, Orwell got it surprisingly right. But what he did get wrong, if we're going to talk about this, I think you've hit the nail on the head, that really the way in which the universal presence of television screens is being used is the other way round. It's what people are looking at which is keeping them very passive and manipulable, if there is such a word. So it's more what we're being forced to look at rather than what people looking at us, really. It's the other way around. But there's a lot of... I find it... it's a novel of realism. A lot of the novel is actually set in Trafalgar Square, although it's been renamed Victory Square. But it's obviously... it's a very detailed description of Trafalgar Square, and some of the key scenes in the novel take place there. And, funnily enough, I was in Trafalgar Square last night on my way home from work. I worked near there. I actually was in Trafalgar Square thinking about all of this and looking at it. And really, it's... to me, it's not like a futuristic thing at all. The scenes of the novel that take place in what he describes as Victory Square, with the lions and the Nelson's Column and all the rest of it, there's nothing very realistic about them. It's very much of its time, set in post-war London. The whole flavour of the novel, that's why I say it's probably not the best question to ask whether he got it right for the future. It's more what he was talking about then. There's a very strong flavour of post-war austerity and the grimness and frustrations of life around London in that time. In a sense, that's what Orwell was best at. I mean, his early novels are much more like that. His earlier novels are very much not political, but more social commentary, social critique on the sort of oddities of the English class system, in inverted commas, as he would call it, not in terms of the real class difference between working class and capitalist class, but kind of sociological differences. Things like A Clergyman's Daughter, Keep the Aspidistra Flying. I mean, he was almost obsessed with the idea of, obsessively irritated at times, but also fascinated with the idea of the prim and proper, polite and respectable middle-class life in England. He was fascinated by the idea of English culture, and he was himself in many ways embedded in it. So all of those themes are just as important in this book as the kind of grand futuristic schemes of the future. The main... thing that he got right in political terms in this book is the buying off of rebellion. To me, that's the main positive thing that comes out of this in terms of a warning, if you like. But what is so frightening about the book is the idea that even the one sort of plot or rebellion which raises the reader's hopes turns out to be a sham, turns out to have been almost certainly artificially created by the state. But there's something in that, because so much discontent, it may not be fabricated by the state in quite the same way, but very much of the discontent which inevitably arises in capitalism is certainly placated in one sense or another. It can be channeled into vacuous and useless futilities. In many ways, there are safety valves on the left in particular, which they may not have been functionally set up with that conscious purpose in mind, but the net effect is the same. There are safety valves on the left which say to people, if you're discontented, follow this path, and you might get it off your chest and feel slightly better, but absolutely nothing will change. And it's exactly the same flavour of rebellion just being bought off or being stifled, not really getting anywhere. But the flaw is that frustrated vista is completely remorseless. There's no chink in the armoury. Whereas in reality, there is that small chink in the armour, there's that small crack of light where there is the possibility of genuine resistance and opposition to capitalism. In this work, there's nothing. There's no chink of light whatsoever.
Come back to Orwell and class. I think you said at some point you described yourself as lower middle class, but I think what you actually described yourself as lower upper middle class. I mean, it would make quite a difference, because in fact, he went to Eton. and he was a member of the impoverished upper class. Right. If he'd been a member of the lower middle class, he'd have written a completely different book.
He was a scholarship boy.
So you can say, okay, he wasn't the mind of God, but he came from the caste, if you like, that was the caste of gentlemen who were governing the empire. But he wasn't lower middle class in that in the sense which is
his
parents.
But his parents.
No,
I don't think so. Come back again. This thing about language is a very important part of the discussion, I think. See, there's a sort of savage irony about Orwell and this warning, which I think you want to give, about the way in which language, political language, could be used to narrow the range of thought that could degenerate into a few. This labels that everybody uses collectively. The savage irony is that of all writers, Orwell made one of the greatest contributions to this impoverishment of critical thought, because it was through his work that socialism became associated collectively in people's minds, not just in others as well, with tyranny. Socialism equals obliteration of individuality, political collectivism, state control, the most vicious kind. So, as I say, that's an irony about this particular part of the discussion, that Orwell himself contributed to the prejudiced use of collective political labels, which had the effect of reducing critical thought. Can I just make one other point? You see, if you think about how governments operate now, this particular government, or just on its class beginnings, I mean, that you can tell the sort of class that Orwell came from in that quote that Cliff gave about the chap who was talking about the old days in Hyde Park, the sort of language that was ascribed to that problem. I mean, that is exactly the kind of crude caricature of working class language that upper class people use, and that tells you more about the great deal of it. I mean, that was so corny and so bad, isn't it? I mean, it just screws you up in embarrassment. If you come back to what governments, how they behave, and how the state behaves, if you were to tell John Major, any government now, but they were able to manipulate and control, that wouldn't be called in the least way with their experience as managers of the state, because they just blunder from one situation where they're totally unable to control things to another, from one political crisis to another, and they're desperately trying to ingratiate themselves with popular opinion. And it's his bad luck, the Conservative Party. That government's bad luck now, and they just can't seem to be able to do it. So the actual reality of the state controlling people's minds in that direct way just doesn't match up with reality at all. People like John Major only wish it was that way for just 10 minutes of the day.
Yeah, sure, what you say about the land. In fact, I probably didn't even read it as badly as it's written. I was too embarrassed to miss out, you know, all the T's and H's and everything. There's more apostrophes in that paragraph than letters. I didn't fancy reading it that way. But in fact, equally revealing is the language of Julia, the female heroine rebel. In the most unlikely way, Orwell, particularly when writing the speech of the woman, seems to have foundered. And whereas, she was a... she wasn't of the pro category. She like Winston Smith, she was an outer party member, not an inner party member. But nevertheless, I won't waste time looking through it now, but there are some choice examples where Julia in particular speaks in this extremely refined, posh sort of way in terms of the choice of words, which doesn't seem to ring true at all with the situation that they're in, or even with the other characters in that context. And the choice of language that Julia uses in her speech, if you look it up, you'll see what I mean. It sounds like something from a vicarage tea party again, you can tell from the language that's being used the kind of background that the writer may have come from. And it goes back to the point that's been made over here about which class Orwell came from. I mean, as I said earlier, I think that he's an interesting example of somebody who it would be harder to categorise now. I think there have been some changes in that respect over the past 50 years, where there are some categories of person which are probably less in existence now to be found than they may have been just then. In other words, I think it was The Last of the Dying Breed in terms of this lower upper.
Wasn't there a film about 1984, or a play?
Yeah, two
different films. There was one
was a play, wasn't it? But it was banned, wasn't it? At one point, by BBC?
Yes, the original film version was banned by the BBC. It was shown once in the 1960s, when I first saw it, but the BBC refused to show it again. But in 1984, obviously, a new version was made with...
John Hurt.
O'Brien.
And Richard Burton was Smith.
But that old version of the film must have been shown since 1960, because I've seen the old one as well. So they must have shown that old film since then. Mm-hmm. It was Jonathan Pryce.
In the old version.
No. Jonathan Pryce, the Shakespearean actor, was in the new version.
Wasn't that Brazil?
He was in that as well. Why did the BBC ban the old version? Because I have seen the old version, so they must have unbanned it at one stage or another.
It's too
horrific. I must say that probably the most horrific thing I've ever seen on television was that final scene, the original version of 1984. The rats were very, very horrific. It's quite amazing, it just shows what black and white cinematography can do. Incidentally, the name of the book that I was trying to remember is called The World, the Flesh and the Devil. That was the name of the book written by Graham, I remembered it. And the other point about Peter Lawrence when Fisher and this and the savage irony, you know, it's not such a savage irony. I don't know how many of you have read Orwell's essays. I'm not a great fan of them myself, but he did write one which is often neglected in discussion about 1984 and language. And is an essay called New Words. And this was when he was very much under the influence of Ogden. And he was actually going to write, Orwell and Ogden were going to run a campaign through the Tribune newspaper to try and promote this new language where people can't say bad things. It's called Basic English, based on the book Basic English. But the point about it was that Orwell's actually promoting exactly what Newspeak was, as a matter of fact. And I recommend Peter Lawrence, in relation to his own, to read this essay, because it's amazing. I mean, it's the old thing that I have been pushing on about through this entire series, that the essence of great literature is this tremendous tension and ambivalence in all writing. And Orwell is just as much part of this as anyone else. And Orwell actually was primarily concerned about the dangers of over-classification, precisely because he was very tempted to use it himself, just as H.G. Wells, who was mentioned earlier, was both a utopian and a dystopian novelist, because he actually couldn't make up his mind whether the future was going to be absolutely perfect or absolutely awful. And the other point that I wanted to mention, I just wondered whether anybody here could think of any other nightmare scenarios of the future, which they think are preferable. I mean, I said that I think Brave New World is the most frighteningly realistic vision of the future that has ever been written about the 20th century. Now, there are other ones to mention. Nobody responded to the book that I mentioned, The World of Malay, although I don't know why nobody writes about that. Nobody apart from Brian August has ever mentioned it in connection with 1984. But it was published the same year, and it postulated many of the same things. It was a pretty badly written novel, instead. But, I mean, there's Clockwork Orange, which was written in 1963, published in 1963 by Anthony Burgess.
There's another one which is very relevant to 1984 called Slave War 17. It was published in the late 60s, I can't remember exactly when, by Frank DeMaine. There's probably one of the most powerful novels about language, which I would recommend anyone to read, which was written in 73 in fact, by Ian Watson, called Embedding. And Embedding is based upon a particular, well, you don't want me to go on there.
No,
you don't. Embedding's a very interesting concept. It's a great novel. If anyone hasn't, if anyone ever gets a chance, go to the library and get hold of Ian Watson's science fiction scenario, Embedding, which really talks about language in a way much more sophisticated and much more, with much greater literary skill than Orwell.
It's a very brief play, apparently, but that play, Mountain Language, which was one of Harold Pinter's recent plays a couple of years ago, I think. I don't really know, I think it was on television or something, but that's very much on the theme of how language or language control is used against people. Although it's slightly different because it's actually a case of people being told that they're not permitted to use their own language. And of course there are many real cases of that around the world, or there have been, where for political reasons people are told not to use their own language.
But for people in the world of Malé, where people of the earth is invaded by
the entire planet is told not to use their own language.
But I wonder if anyone can think of any nightmarish scenarios which they would like to tell us about. For example, Sam Yarkin's We.
I was just about to mention that, funny enough, when you took the floor from me again, but you need a bit of chairmanship. a bit of competition from the front to the back. I was just about to say that Isaac Deutscher, who was being mentioned earlier, claims that this book, We, by Sam Yatin, was the model for 1984. And in fact, Deutscher says that the plot is identical, the structure of the plot, the various characters and so on, and the whole tone, the tenor of the work. According to Deutscher, and I haven't read We, but according to Deutscher, he says that it's virtually identical. And so convinced was he that 1984 was a direct rewrite of Sam Yatin's We, that he looked through Orwell's diaries and letters, and sure enough found not just a reference to Orwell having recently or shortly before read Sam Yatin's We, but having gone a stage further and complained, Orwell was complaining, that it wasn't available in translation at that time. He had to read it in French or something, but it wasn't available in English because it was a Russian novel. And apparently Orwell read it in French or something, some other language, and complained that it hadn't been translated into English, and that he was very interested in the possibility of this happening. He said it needed a wider audience, and it would be very interesting to place it in an English context. There seems to be a lot of evidence to say that Orwell may have based 1984 on Sam Yatin's We.
This comes from the category of irony, but I think we've been typing basic English. Now, 20 years ago, I was a member of our Haringey draft, and I was a member of that draft who had a Dean in it, and he translated our Declaration of Principles into basic English. Now, that would suggest that you can express critical comments or linguistic society in basic English, but he did
it in Glossop.
No, this is basic English. And his reason for doing this was that for people whose first language isn't English, you know, people from most of the rest of the world, they might find it easier to understand what we were going to say if it was in clear, in a clear, concise form without ambiguity. So I don't know what the philosophy was behind basic English, but I've seen stuff in basic English, and it can't be that bad. As I say, if we can translate our Declaration of Principles into it.
I'd just like to mention
a 1984
scenario that I've never curriculum that's which, again, it's an attempt to impose a kind of standardisation of the way young people learn, and particularly the debate in the 20th between firstly bilingualism in the English for children from school languages other than English, which is really not barely any recognition of the importance of that. And also standard English and the way in which people speak.
Once again, it's suggested in the novel that Goldstein may have also been somehow manufactured by the regime. Because, I mean, Big Brother, the symbolic figurehead of the regime, turns out to have been an artificial creation who never dies or is born. It's just the idea of this anonymous party ruling through creating images, just manipulating ideas. So there's no real Big Brother, there's no real Goldstein. It was really Goldstein was sort of created out of thin air. And given a persona, which could then be used as a kind of, what do you call it?
Hate figure.
But you're right, there is a direct...
First, Moscow show trials, Trotsky is the ultimate figure of hate.
Absolutely, I mean, the comparison with... what was Trotsky's original name?
Bronstein.
So it's a similar name as well. But I mean, and as for Goldstein, it's Jeffrey Myers, who I referred to earlier, who's written about Orwell, and said that the regime was anti-Semitic, goes further and says that Goldstein was there because of the Jewish name, and therefore this was somehow shows once again that the regime is being presented as anti-Semitic, which I think is quite fallacious. This was the one who said about face crime being having Semitic features. This is complete nonsense. I mean, the fact is Goldstein is there as a figure of hate. Because to represent, once again, a channel for discontent. And the way in which it operates is that because Winston Smith has these slight tendencies of doubt about the regime, it's never adequately explained how or why this happens, of course. Why does this isolated figure, who seems fairly ordinary in most other respects, decide to start opposing the regime in a way in which millions of people around him don't? There's no context or background for any of that, which again makes the novel somewhat less realistic than it may have been in that respect. But since, for whatever reason, Winston decides to, he has these doubts, Goldstein is there as a kind of magnet to attract all those doubters that there may be in society towards opposition. But in fact, has actually been fabricated by the regime itself. But I think the idea of this is come from Trotsky. And I didn't realise this until recently when I was reading some stuff in preparation for this, but apparently Orwell himself had quite an ambiguous relationship towards the ideas of Trotsky. Apparently in some of his writings, his diaries or his essays, he at times expressed some sympathy for the ideas of Trotsky himself, and at other times not. I mean, I think Orwell seems to have been fundamentally somewhat confused thinker politically. I think that's what, when it boils down to it. I mean, a work like 1984 has been the subject of such circumspection over the years, scrutinising every word. And what's sometimes lost in all of that is that when all said and done, it was written by a novelist who was an ex-journalist and who wrote a book which, you know, was there to, as a marketable product, in fact, like any other. It was selling many copies. It was entertaining to read. But as a political thinker, he was obviously rather confused. I don't think it's fair to even debate Orwell as a great political thinker, because he clearly wasn't.
Well, I think that's what you're saying. It's the same problem that applies to many other writers. People get over-analysed. You know, these critics read things into what writers have written which aren't there. It's the same thing.
When Orwell sits down and writes political ideas in a straightforward way as an essay, if you look at his essays, then it's fairer to obviously debate the political inadequacies or otherwise of his analysis. But the whole problem, of course, with the novel form is that it has this great power to influence and inspire people because of its literary flourishes. It does also make it rather more difficult to analyse in detail politically because of its impressionistic devices. I mean, for example, I quoted from the novel extensively when I spoke earlier on. And, for example, I was demonstrating Orwell's debate in his own mind about whether or not real change was possible in society. And I said that the conclusion was very negative, and there was this quotation about the party will rule forever, the proles will never do anything. But of course, that wasn't Orwell speaking, technically. That was actually O'Brien. It was a quote within a quote. And, of course, by hiding behind these various characters, the novelist gains the right to be non-committal, to sit on the fence in a way in which the essayist cannot.